Quel est le point de départ?
Wrestling fans, and welcome to Shut Up and Wrestle, a wrestling history podcast about good conversations and great stories. I am your host, Brian R. Solomon, and this is episode 115, featuring Deshaun Whipple and Joe Walker of the Whip Show podcast. Before we get to this week's episode, a few items of note that I would like to mention. Blood, Sweat, and Tears Wrestling, BST Wrestling, the Connecticut-based independent wrestling organization that I've been doing some announcing work with as of late, they are coming back to the Devonshire Hall in Hamden, Connecticut, the night of Friday, April 19th. That's coming up very soon, and the reason I mention it, in addition to it just being a great show like they always put on, but I will be there once again as a guest commentator. If you want to come down and check out the show, that's Devonshire Hall, Friday, April 19th, BST Wrestling Elevate 2. I'll be on hand. They'll also be posting the event to independentwrestling.tv. That is after the fact, if you can't make it to the Hamden, Connecticut area. I'll also be there selling and signing copies of Blood and Fire. If you'd like to get one, come on down. I'd love to even just say hello to you. Also, issue number 43 of Inside the Ropes, featuring Sting on the cover, is on sale now. I've got an article in there on a lot of the corporate shakeups happening in the world of wrestling lately, namely the departure of Vince McMahon from WWE, and a lot more than that, including Scott D'Amore leaving TNA and other kind of shakeups. That is in the new issue, 43 of Inside the Ropes. Get it at InsideTheRopesMagazine.com. On the Irresistible Force front, the life and times of Gorilla Monsoon, I'm proud to say that I finished Chapter 7 of the book, and I'm now moving into Chapter 8 of the book, which is going to be an interesting one, which covers the tail end of the 60s going into the 1970s, the years, really, that Gorilla becomes a partner in the Capitol Wrestling Corporation, so much more than just a wrestler. So this is a very important chapter. It also marks the halfway point of the writing process, which I started last fall, because it's 7 chapters down, 7 more to go. So I'm excited. I hope you're excited too. I'll keep you abreast of the progress of the book. But for now, I'd like to actually get to this week's conversation. So Deshaun Whipple, a.k.a. the Whip Dog, and Mr. Joe Walker have had me on their podcast, The Whip Show, which stands for Wrestling History and Insiders Podcast. A couple of times, we had a great time, and I was more than happy to bring them on board here at Shut Up and Wrestle. What you're going to hear now, a great conversation full of nostalgia and memories, a great three-way conversation that we had here on Shut Up and Wrestle that I think you're going to enjoy very, very much. I'm going to take you to it right now. Okay, so something different this week on Shut Up and Wrestle. I have not one, but two guests with me this week. I've been on their show a couple of times, and we'll talk about that. Maybe some of you have heard those appearances, but they're very knowledgeable guys, and I thought it would be a great idea to return the favor and bring them right here to Shut Up and Wrestle. From the Wrestling Histories and Insider Podcast, otherwise known as The Whip Show, I'm proud to welcome Whip and Mr. Joe Walker to Shut Up and Wrestle. Thanks for coming on the show, guys.
Thank you very much, man. Even though that was not bad of an intro, but it's the Wrestling Heroes and Insiders Podcast.
What did I say?
But you said the wrestling history, but we're historians as well, so that's fine. It's cool.
I literally wrote it down to make sure I didn't do that. Because you know why? Every time I introduce my own show, at the top of the show, I always say a wrestling history podcast. And so it was just like my gut reaction, yes. I'm not going to redo this. We're just rolling with it. It's the Wrestling Heroes and Insiders podcast.
I took some history classes once.
See?
There you go. We all got through it, right? I met my first wife in a college history class, so something must have clicked.
See?
Yeah. But enough about me. Let's talk about wrestling. So one of the things that I mentioned when I first was introducing you guys is that I've been on your show a couple of times, and I just want to say, I'm not just saying it because you're here and I'm talking to you, but one of the reasons I wanted to do this, especially, I've done so many podcasts, especially since the Sheik book came out. It's beyond belief how many. Like, sometimes I feel like I don't even remember like what show I'm on. There are times where, no offense to anyone who might be wondering, was that me? But there are times where I'm just like, what is this again? Like, okay, talk about the Sheik. Okay, yeah, sure. But your guys' show was one of my favorite experiences, and one of the both times I've been on, one of the best shows that I've ever been on. And I mean that because, look, a big piece of the puzzle is you actually know what the hell you're talking about, and not everybody does.
That's a fact, man. And we definitely appreciate that, man. We try to be knowledgeable.
There was, I mean, as you could probably guess, there were a couple of times for the Sheik book. It happened more than once. There were a couple of times where maybe 15 minutes, 20 minutes in, I realized this person thinks that I wrote a book about the Iron Sheik.
Are you serious?
Yeah, it happened. Stop. This person obviously has not read the book, and they just heard Wrestling and Sheik, and that's that. And I have to just sort of like politely correct them or go along with it. So you get some stuff like that, or just, you know, also you get a lot of the same questions and things. And you guys, especially, and Whip, even the first time I was on, I think the first time I was on, it was just me and you, right?
Yeah. I think. Just kind of vibing about your book.
It's just like, you know, I like getting to talk about not just topics that I'm not always talking about, but even just different angles. Like, I don't mind talking about the Sheik book and or working for WWE, right? But as long as I get a chance to tell maybe some stories I never told before or some ideas that I never touched on before, like, I don't know if I could deal with one more person asking me what was the most interesting thing you learned about the Sheik that you didn't know. Like, at this point, my answer would be nothing, because I've been thinking about it for 5 years.
So can I say something real quick, right? So yeah. Anybody out there that's a podcaster or a journalist, you know, it's good to go to school. You should. But remember, personalize yourself. Have fun with it as well. Don't be so robotic and ask the same questions over and over. Just my thoughts.
Totally. I taught journalism even in high school for a little bit. Mm. And I took a little bit. I would never call myself, you know, an expert. I took a little bit in college. I wrote about wrestling most of my writing career. If anything, like, being a journalist works against you doing that kind of stuff. But I always taught my students that I worked with the same thing. It's like, you know, be yourself. Try to be engaging. Don't be mechanical. Like, one of the things that I hate, and this isn't just a wrestling thing, this is in all interviews, the worst thing, and I'm sorry if you guys have done this, but one of the things I hate when an interviewer does is, like, they can't put the effort in to even think up a question. They'll just think of a topic. So they'll say, like, someone will say, like, talk to me about working for WWE. Like, no. Okay, what specifically? Like, could you not be bothered to even think of subjects? You just, like, they'll put it on the interviewee, just like, just talk about stuff. Just, I will give you a list of stuff and just talk about it. I hate that.
You see my face right now?
Yeah.
Good. I'm glad. I thought you guys were going to be like, hey, we do that all the time. You know,
it bothers me to be a part of it, and also to see it when I watch interviews, when they're like, okay, I got a question. I got a good question for you. Tell me about working for.
Oh, yeah. You'll see it even.
It's not a question.
You'll see it in TV news. You'll see it in TV, you know, high profile interviews on television. You'll see them just go, talk about this, or tell us about this. And it's just so vague. And you get the best, people get the best responses out of people when they know exactly the right questions to ask. In fact, I don't want to just make the whole show about me, but I just earlier today, I was doing research for the Gorilla Monsoon book, and I was trying to find out stuff about Bill Watts and when he was in the WWF in the 60s, because they were a tag team together and all that stuff. And I went and I dug up Brian Last's interview that he did
with Bill Watts. Like when Bruno Sammartino died, he tracked him down. He's not an easy guy to get because I've interviewed him as well. And it's like you have to pass all these tests of knowledge for him to even talk to you. And it was just I complimented him earlier today. And it's not just because this podcast is on his network, but I complimented him on what a great interview it was. Like he knew exactly what to ask. This is somebody that does not like to come out of his shell. He's probably been asked the same things a million times. And he got stuff out of him that I don't think anybody had ever heard about anywhere else. So, I mean, like it all comes down to how you conduct the interview.
Agree, man. And another thing, guys, if you're out there, listen. If you're asking somebody a question, listen to what they said. Sometimes people ask these questions because they have 20 questions written down, and that's all they care about. Nothing else. They didn't hear anything the person they're interviewing is saying. It's
oh, yeah. You can see that even on TV talk shows because there you could actually see the person, and you can clearly see this person's not listening to anything they're saying. They're just waiting till they get to ask the next question. And you also, when you do that, you lose sight of the fact that maybe there's a good point for a follow-up question. Like if somebody just said something that blew your mind, or you're not going to just let them get off the hook with just saying that one thing, don't just go to the next question like a machine. Just go with the flow. What do you think this show is? I always tell people, this is not an interview. People get all nervous. Like, well, what are our topics? What are we going to talk about? What are you going to? And I'm like, I don't know, whatever you want to talk about. It's a complete free-flowing conversation. Any questions I ask or people ask me, it just comes out of whatever conversation we're having. I really don't prep this. I'm sorry to say, I don't.
Can I let go of a secret real quick since you said that? So there's a big wrestling company, and I have a friend that works for that company. He's a wrestler, and I had him on as a guest. Not going to say his name, but the head of talent relations was like, please send us the 15 to 20 questions you're going to ask. Okay, I did it. Didn't really want to do that because, again, I like to just kind of flow.
Right.
Soon as he got on air, he said, now take that list, Whip, and throw it out the window. Let's have some fun. You know what I mean?
Good for him. I mean, those people are just doing their job, but yeah, you know, you understand. But yeah.
You know what? I have declined in 25, almost 26 years now. Yeah, I guess it has been 26 years. I've declined so many interviews because in the process, they're like, well, send me what you're going to ask. And I'm like, I don't do that.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. If it's the company that I think it is, which in my mind, there could only be one company that would go that far, because the other possible company I could think of it would be, in my experience, is far less strict, far less, almost to a fault with those kind of things. But
there are so many.
They're
dealing with PR firms and publicists and stuff. There are so many. Like, well, send me the questions ahead of time. Send us the questions you're going to ask.
Well, the worst thing ever, and thankfully we don't have to deal with this because we do, you know, podcasting, is when somebody insists on just only being interviewed via email. That's crazy to me because there's people. I've had that happen on occasion, and I understand why. If you're interviewing them about something that's really research intensive and it's really heavy information, I get it. They need to look things up and things like that, and they need to make sure they're accurate. But if you can't just comfortably carry out a conversation, I'm just going to interview you about you. Like, you don't need to research that. If you need me to send you want me to send you the questions and then you're going to send me the answers back? I mean, invariably, those interviews are terrible. And those are the ones that I usually turn down. If I'm doing something in print, I'll just say no, then I'm not even going to bother. And I tell my students that because they are – because, look, they're from that smartphone age, so they are way more comfortable texting than talking to people. So they love doing that. They're like, yeah, you just want to do it by email? That's great. I don't have to have, you know, human contact. And I always tell them, you are never going to get anything as interesting or compelling in an email as you are from just talking to somebody. Never. It's just never going to be as interesting.
It can be, too. And it still depends on the question, because let me backtrack. If I'm planning to talk to the person one-on-one, and this is what I want to do, and then they say, send me your questions, that's in a situation where I would decline. No, I don't want to do that. But I actually do a series, an interview series or a Q&A series where I send the questions and have the person send their answers back because I want them to sit and reflect on it. I don't want you to just give me a snap answer, even though those in-the-moment answers I love. But I want them to sit and think about these things a little bit before they answer, and then You know, if they write it and read it and they don't like what they said, you know, rewrite it, erase it, edit it, do whatever you need to do to make it sound best to you, or it's a good reflection of how you feel. But, you know, I like doing those too. I've been doing that since 2015. I started doing that in 2015. I've been doing the series every year since then.
So is that, but is that like a basis for then doing a spoken interview, or is it just more like something where they work the answers out and they'll, because I figure like either way, at least you're getting a chance to elaborate on the answers. You could then go back to them and say, what did you mean by this? What did you mean by that? But I just find that sometimes I don't want people to be too calculated in the answers they give, because they're going to like sit there and dwell on it and give like the perfect, perfect, safe, sometimes safe response. And I wouldn't mind doing it as a prep, like, okay, let's go over some topics if you want. And what might you say about this, that, or the other thing? But I just feel like you get people way more comfortable when you're talking to them, you know, because then they let their guard down. You know, sometimes that could be a great thing.
Well, the idea of the series is for them to reflect. And I've had great success with it. And, you know, but when I started doing it, the whole idea was the questions and the arrangement of the questions, because one takes you from one feeling into another. So it's kind of hard to dance around the sentiment of it, because each question deals with reflecting on, you know, whatever it is in life you're going through at that time. And that's what I do it at the end of the year, every year. I've been doing it since 2015. And I did a spinoff of it in 2020, where I had 20 questions that I asked 20 different people. And like 15 of the 20 people were like, this is the most fun I've had doing something like this ever, which is great. But then I got some really heartfelt stuff, because this was pandemic too. So what I did was take everybody through their life from the time they were a child to where they sat right now being locked down.
And it just got me with it too.
Just made them think about their experiences, and did they ever think in life they would ever be in this moment where they're like, I don't know what to do. I've never felt like this before. So I took them up and I brought them down. And some of those answers, man, they were incredibly sincere. But again, they were sitting there like, you know, some people had lost loved ones. Some of them had, you know, had some health scares already themselves with the virus, and, you know, come face to face with their own mortality. It was timely. Put it like that. It was timely.
And it was such an unprecedented. I'm very proud of how it turned out. Yeah, it was such an unprecedented time too. I mean, to be chronicling something like that and getting those people on the record like that, and that kind of oral history in a way of what was going on, I think is always going to be valuable. I sometimes try to focus on that even with what I'm doing, whether it's wrestling related or not. It's just everything that we do contributes to the body of knowledge on whatever it is. And I think that's an important role. You know, I didn't know what to expect. I've never wrestled in my life. I've been interviewing wrestlers since I was in college, which is like about 30 years now. It's coming up on this, actually right about now, 30 years ago is when I started writing for local papers, college papers, things like that. And I would occasionally cross paths with wrestlers. And so then WWE and beyond and all those other things. And, you know, I didn't know what to expect with all that. And I have to say, yes, wrestlers are nuts. There's no question about it. They'll be the first ones to tell you. They're not like normal human beings. They're not. But the amount of really negative experiences that I've had, or, you know, because you never know what you always expect. You know, am I going to be intimidated, or are they going to like try to, you know, get hostile with me? You never know. The amount of times that anything like that has happened to me, would I can count on one hand. And I have done hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of interviews. I don't even know how many over the last 30 years, and almost never have I had an unpleasant experience. So that's been, I don't know what you guys have found, but that's been a relief too.
I'm kind of on that same wavelength. I don't think I've had any that was pretty bad yet. Knock on wood. I will say it doesn't hurt that I'm 6'5", 300 pounds myself. But, you know, I'm just saying, I haven't really had a bad problem with any of the guys. But I think it also, because of my interview style, I'm trying to have fun with you. We're just having a communication. We're just talking. We're having a conversation.
Right.
I'm not trying to make the wrestling business look bad. I'm trying to make it look better, you know, and just have fun. So I think guys understand that. And I've always had some great interviews. One of my best interviews was John Cena Sr. His dad is awesome.
Dude. He is amazing.
He's super awesome, man.
He's amazing.
He's great. Mark Henry, another one, man. Mark Henry is amazing, dude. AEW gave me him for 5 minutes. We went about 45. Because he was just vibing and having a great time.
Five minutes. What did they expect you were going to do in 5 minutes? That doesn't say make that any sense.
AEW Collision is coming to Toledo, Ohio this Saturday. That's what I really wanted to put over.
Well, he's great. You know,
I had a good interview with Mark Henry, too. And I got to interview John Cena, like, out of the countless number of interviews I've done. I haven't done a whole lot of professional wrestlers, but I've had my share. And the ones I was blessed to talk to, they were some good ones and significant. But Mark Henry was a really good one. And he actually called me while I was cooking dinner for the interview. So I'm in the middle of cooking and I had my son answer the phone, my middle son, and Mark sat and talked to him, man, for like 20 minutes.
That's so nice.
I didn't even know who he was on the phone with when he called. He was like, calling. I'm like, grab it for me.
He answered,
and he was sitting there talking. I'm thinking it's somebody in the family.
I've had some weird experiences.
Recliner, like rocking, that. Talking to whoever. And then I get on the phone and he's like, great kid you got there. I'm like, oh, great. Snap.
And he's great on Busted Open. I mean, he's great on there. He's an insightful guy. He's an interesting guy because now he's been, it's funny, like I've watched him his entire career, you know, from when he first came in as the Olympic weightlifter and everything. And so sometimes with some of those guys where you've watched their entire career from the beginning, sometimes you forget like how they're now these wise older veterans. You still think of them as a rookie or something. And I'm like, wow, Mark Henry is now like one of the elder statesmen of pro wrestling. Same thing for Cena too. Yeah. Like when you said Cena, you interviewed like John Cena Jr. Mm-hmm. Cena? Okay.
Yeah. See,
because I got to know him when he was still kind of unknown in WWE, and that was a crazy experience because, you know, he probably wouldn't be able to pick me out now in a lineup because it's been so long, but back at the time when I worked there, you know, he always kind of gave me special time and made time for me and would always take note of me wherever we were because I had been one of the first people to interview him when he was still living in his parents' basement in Massachusetts and like when the real big checks hadn't started coming in yet, but he was already on TV, but he wasn't really getting big money yet. I think when John Cena first, look, I have never gotten rich doing this, not even close. But when John Cena first debuted on TV in 2002 or three, I think I was making more than he was, like working at WWE. And I was not independently wealthy by any means, share of the imagination. But he was so down to earth. And what I loved about him is that he didn't change. A lot of those guys, they change and they're not the same anymore. And then they start to big time you and everything. And in my experience, he never got like that. Like I got to know him from when he was humble and not really known and just a big wrestling fan. And a great sense of humor, really like really funny sense of humor, and he just sort of just stayed that guy. It was very cool.
So I'm gonna
shared this story publicly. After interviewing John, we sat and talked for a long time. We exchanged information, and you know it that kind of stuff happens after interviews sometimes, but you never expect to really hear from anybody again. But he used to call my house when he would be on the road. And, you know, seeing the success he's achieved, not that I want anything from him. I just regret that I lost that friendship, that we lost contact with each other over the years. Because I used to enjoy that. And sometimes he would call and you could tell he just might need a vent or whatever. You know, he's on the road by himself, driving.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was cool, you know. And No, I was just happy to see him succeed. And after sitting down and talking with him for so long, and having conversations with him, just to see how regular he was.
Mm-hmm.
He was so regular. And that's what I enjoyed about him.
Well, just what you're talking about, though, is something I think that happens to so many of us that do this kind of thing, because it's, you don't want to walk, step over that line. And sometimes you don't know where the line is. Like, I know in my mm-hmm. case, there have been times where I've been like, oh, I should call that guy, or I wish I, you know, we should keep in touch. And then I start thinking, like, he doesn't want to hear from me. Like, he was just being mm-hmm. nice to me. I'm not sure of that, but I'm thinking, like, I'm not going to bother him, or he's got better things to do, or blah, blah, blah. And then you regret it later. Yeah. Because in some cases, I think, you know, you could form friendships if you just are more open to it. And then sometimes people pass away. Like when I was interviewing Terry Funk, and I got to know him I got to know him pretty well when I was working on the Chic mm-hmm. book. And I always felt like he, you know, to be honest, because I could talk about it more now, I didn't want to at the time,
right.
But he seemed very lonely and sad, honestly. And mm-hmm. he was, you know, because he was in an assisted living facility. And I don't think he really wanted to be there. Wow. Like a lot of people don't. I don't think he agreed with the decision, let's just say, to have him be there. And there were times where I'm like, I should call Terry or text him or something. And now and then I would, because I was older and wiser by that point, and thinking like, sometimes these guys really are looking for somebody to talk to, and you have to be able to tell the difference, you know?
I think that's why it's important, man. And in my past years, I was an independent wrestler myself, and I still do commentary at some local independent shows. And back when I was started, the rule was, don't be a mark. Even right. if you're in a business, don't take a picture with somebody. But now I think that narrative is changing a little bit, because just like you said with Terry Funk, collect these memories, man. Build these bonds, build these bridges, take a picture, enjoy it, because there's a lot of wrestlers that I've met over the years that, again, because we know the business that we're in, they're not here anymore. And I wish I would have some type of detailed picture or some of our text messages or anything that we just could have built a bigger bond. So to yeah. the people out there, the young guys that's in this business, I know what they used to say. Enjoy your time in it, man. Enjoy your time in this business.
It's true. I mean, you know, that's something that I've had to sort of, again, find the happy medium. Like, because when I worked at WWE, man, they do not want you doing that. And there's a very practical reason not to right. do it when you're there, because you could lose your job if it becomes like an ongoing thing, or they could look at you, they could lose respect for you. And I'm not saying that's fair or right, but that, at least at the time that I was there, that was very real. But if you're not in a situation like that, there's right. no reason why you can't let your guard down a little bit more and relax. Mm-hmm. And like you said, also the younger generation of wrestlers, who quite honestly, more of them are genuine fans of wrestling and grew up as fans, they have a little bit of a different attitude about it. I think some of the older guys, they did have, to be honest with you, almost a kind of a contempt for people that they thought were too much like fans. That really is something that I sensed a lot, because these were people that were just, they were straight, just strictly businessmen. It was strictly business. And if they saw you, like, they didn't even want to answer questions. Like, I remember I would have to interview people about matches or titles or whatever, and some of these guys just did not want to hear it. They would just be like, I have no idea. I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know what title I won in what town. Just make up whatever you want. You know, I don't care, and don't talk to me. And that, you know, that would happen sometimes. But the younger guys, they tended to be much more enthusiastic, and they approached it more as fans in a way than the older generation of wrestlers did. And so I think now that some of those guys now are becoming the old guard, it's becoming a much more, I don't know, like, fan-friendly environment than it
used to be. I know a lot of people who have a feeling about this gentleman I'm about to say, but for me, he was beneficial, and he helped me. Mark Carano. And I know a lot of people, like I said, I know a lot of people feel some type of way about him.
I worked with Mark.
Okay. But the time that I was an extra, you know, he was our handler. And at the end of this show, when he brought the four of us extras in there to meet the Undertaker at the end of the show, I mean, obviously, we're independent pro wrestlers, but we're extras. It was just the amazing feeling. And Undertaker was the sweetest guy.
Yep.
How you doing, big fella? Good to meet you. He sat there with us, kicked it with us for like 10, 15 minutes. This is after Monday Night Raw. So, you know, he's ready to go home. But even that, man, it just was an amazing experience, man. So like you said, a lot of the younger guys are more involved in actually being wrestling fans as well.
And I'm going to tell you something about Undertaker, and I don't mean to just like match your stories, like, oh, I met that guy too.
No.
But when you tell me these things, when both of you, it triggers memories that I have and thoughts that I have, but that it really agrees with what you're saying too, because I had very little interaction with the Undertaker when I was there, because he was very protected. He was very much like they didn't want him to even be interviewed. He could never break character. None of that kind of thing. So we, as writers and reporters and things, we weren't really around him that much. We weren't allowed to be. But I remember one time I was, you know, if you've been backstage, they have the monitor area where the wrestlers sit and they can watch the show from the back. And I'm sitting there and there's not a lot of people there for whatever reason. Maybe it's like a dead part of the show. And all of a sudden I look next to me and it's the Undertaker. He just sat down next to me and there were a lot of empty seats. He sat down next to me and he just struck up a conversation. He struck up a conversation with me like, hey, man, what's your name? What do you do here? I'm Mark. You know, what's your job? It's good to see you. You having a good time? Blah, blah, blah. Just making small talk again. And you would think, especially one of the biggest names in the company to do that, that remained with me. That made a huge impression on me because that almost never happened, even with guys that were, you know, opening match guys, almost never.
When I interviewed John Cena, I'm just bringing that back because, like I said, very, very few wrestlers, but enough the significant ones. When I meet people that I admire, you know, I have to go in immediately thinking not to go in as a fan, but go in as a, like I'm going in as their colleague or as, you know, an associate. So I keep the fan part out of it. That way I can be a little more objective. When I walked in the room, and this is when John was United States champion. This was not long before he became WWE champion. When I walked in and saw him sitting there, he had on a Mega Man t-shirt. And this immediately opened up. It just, without having to say a word to each other yet, just seeing him in that shirt completely broke the ice. He was one of my favorite wrestlers on TV at the time. And it was so exciting for my sons. Like, oh, man, you're going to talk to John Cena. That's so cool. But to see him in the Mega Man shirt, I'm like, dude, you know, I can sit and talk to you for the next 2 weeks about Mega Man only. You know what I mean? And we just immediately, the connection was there because I saw something in him that was human.
Well, that's what I mean when I say that, you know, he was really down to earth and very relatable. He always was like that. I have a great Cena story, and it's kind of visual. I don't think I've really even ever told it here, but it's a visual thing, but it's something that just killed me at the time. When Cena got the U.S. title, she mentioned when that was the first title that he won, right? The U.S. title, I think it was like 04 or something like that at WrestleMania. I think it was WrestleMania 20. And they gave
Big Show.
Right, Big Show. It was the first spinner belt. So before he had the WWE Championship spinner belt, he had the U.S. title spinner belt. It was his idea to do a spinner, you know, like a spinner medallion, except the belt, right? Because it fit with his character. Yeah, it fit with his character at the time. And it was red, white, and blue, and it had all these stones on it and everything. People remember it. And I will never forget. He did this just to get a rise out of people. I was sitting, this was another time I was with Undertaker, but it was for professional reasons. We were doing a photo shoot for the cover of the magazine or Inside or something, and it was when he was reunited again with Paul Bearer. So this was like around that time period, 2004, before they killed off Paul Bearer, right? In that really dumb angle where they like encased or something. But so it's Paul Bearer and the Undertaker, and we're in this backstage area taking a break in a photo shoot, and we're all just kind of sitting there catching our breath, and the photographers are reloading whatever they're doing, and this again, no one was there to see this but me. Okay, Cena shows up all of a sudden out of nowhere and just like with this big grin on his face. You got to keep in mind there had been nothing like a spinner belt before this big grin on his face. He gets right in Taker's face and Paul Bearer's face, and these are two very old school guys, right? He gets right in their face, with this big grin, and he just starts spinning the belt right in their face, and he's going like, huh? What do you guys think? What do you guys think? And Taker is just like, got his head in his hand, looking at the floor, and he's just like, man, get that the hell out of my face. And he was doing it just to piss off The Undertaker or Paul Bearer. And I thought it was hilarious, but, you know, those are the things, man. You don't, it's like for an audience of one. It's amazing.
That's, you know, awesome. What? Since we're sharing John Cena stories, I'm gonna go ahead and throw you one more. I did this article called The Workout Plan. And I put John Cena and 50 Cent together. And they talked about how their physiques lead to their attraction to fans, especially women.
Wait, so they actually interacted with each other?
No, I did the interview.
Oh, separate. You did. Oh, you did.
And then,
you,
okay. And then put it together. Now, the way I wrote it, you would have thought they were in the same room.
Okay.
They were not. But, and it's probably one of the most well-received. It's up there. I don't know. It was pretty well-received. But people were just like, how did you get them to do an interview together? And I would just go, I'm the word heavyweight champ.
So now this reminds me of something else. Whip, I don't mean to be leaving you out of this, but
go ahead.
Do you guys remember the magazine? I think it was SmackDown Magazine. Have you ever seen the cover with John Cena and Method Man?
Yes.
You know what I'm talking about?
I don't remember that.
Where they're back.
I remember that one.
Okay. So that, because the reason I think about it is that 50 Cent's name came up. We wanted to do, because Cena, he had the rap gimmick when he first started. That was his thing. He was like the Vanilla Ice of WWE or whatever. So we thought like, okay, he's a mid-carder. He's not really a big, they were trying to make him into a big star. If we could get somebody from the rap world to like give him the rub, it would be really cool. And first of all, he was against this from the beginning because he was just
Cena
like,
was?
He was, because he's like, I'm going to look ridiculous. I'm going to look like a poser and a faker and a wannabe, and I don't want to do this. But I think Vince kind of overruled it because they liked the idea. But we wanted to get, for this, Jay-Z.
I remember this.
Yeah, and I don't think, now this was 2004. Jay-Z was already like the king of everything. I don't think the people in the company didn't really realize how big of a deal he was. Because I was like, guys, Jay-Z has more money than Vince. Like, he's not just, you know, a rapper. Like, he's a mogul. He's got an empire. Like, why would he want to do this? And sure enough, they reached out to him. And his response, from what I understand, was, I don't know who this guy is, John Cena. If you want me to do this, why don't we do it with The Rock? Like, I would love to do it with The Rock. And they were like, well, that kind of defeats the point. Like, The Rock, we don't need that. The Rock is already a huge deal. We want to help this guy, to help elevate him. And so he wasn't interested. So no offense to Method Man, but we found somebody who had credibility, who people knew and recognized, but he was easier to get than Jay-Z.
Because Method was a fan of wrestling.
He was. I was amazed because he showed up. Nobody knew what to expect. We were at the photo studio there, and Cena was there, and we showed up, and we're like, what's this going to be like? Like, we kind of thought, like, is he going to just pull up in a limo, and like a giant cloud of smoke is going to come out when he opens the door? Like, what is this? And he couldn't have been more professional. He showed up with props and costumes. I'm not even kidding. That's how much of a fan he was. He showed up, he walked in, and he had a white t-shirt that had the WWF old school winged eagle title belt airbrushed on it. It was his shirt. He was wearing that, and over it he had this powder blue blazer that he said he picked out because it made him look like a manager, like Bobby Heenan or Jim Cornette or somebody that would wear this ugly, like, loud suit jacket. And he wore that, like, he was so over the top with it that we had to be like, listen, this is awesome, we love this, but we don't want you to overdo it because, you know, you're here like to help, you know what I mean? Like, we want you to be who you are. We don't want you to just be kissing our ass and being like a wrestling guy. You know, we want you to be Method Man. So we had to kind of rein him in a little bit, but he knew everything. Like, he was talking to us about Raw and SmackDown and like things that had just happened on the show. Like, He really knew his stuff. That was so cool. And even Cena was so nervous. And by the end of it, I think they became friends. I think they actually wound up doing a movie together later on, like years later. But Cena, it turned out to be better than he thought. He was so nervous. I remember I was in the limo with him before it started because he was getting all his gear ready and everything. And he was like, you could just tell he was like so preoccupied. He's thinking like, oh, this is gonna look so corny. And I said to him, which is the worst thing I ever could have said, I said, look, John, it's like the rock and wrestling connection in the 80s. Now it's the rap and wrestling connection. Yeah. And he's like, please don't say that. Like, that's the exact.
Go ahead.
No, he was just like, that is the corniest thing I've ever heard in my life. And that's exactly what I don't want this to be. So I was like, all right, sorry.
But it's wow, man. It's such a collaboration now, though. First of all, it's got to be amazing. So many people in the quote unquote mainstream world
right.
that love pro wrestling. And mm-hmm. I mean, you're talking about the rap world. There are so many rappers now. I mean, that just love pro wrestling. I mean, you guys met LeBron James at a WWE Raw. That picture is amazing. And you know what picture I'm talking about?
Yeah.
With him holding the picture of Stone Cold Steve Austin. Yep. Like, were you around during that time?
I think that might have been maybe right after I left. Because I remember, actually, it's funny with LeBron. I remember I was working there when he just started, when he just came up. And he was like the rookie that everybody was talking about. So this might have been a little bit after that. But I mean, that would happen. You'd be backstage at the Garden or something, and you'd be like, did I just see who I thought? Like, people used to just like to use their stroke and their influence to get backstage and just hang out. Like, you would see random celebrities do that because they knew they could do it because they had the influence to just be like, hey, I want to come backstage. We'd see ZZ Top anytime we were in California. Ashton Kutcher randomly just showed up at a Raw once, just when he was, you know, married to Demi Moore and he was this huge star and everything. You'd see crazy things like that. And then in the rap world, I mean, forget it. It's like, it's the funniest thing. I know people who, they don't know anything about wrestling, but they like hip hop and they'll be like, why are these guys always talking about wrestling? Like, I don't get it. You know, you got, you know, Cardi B just talked about Superfly Jimmy Snuka. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, she wasn't even born yet when Superfly Jimmy Snuka was coming off the top rope. Like, somebody must have told her about this or somebody's
Nicki
writing.
Nicki Minaj has a Hogan reference in her songs.
Hogan. And there was, well, of course, Ric Flair drip. That's the big one.
Yeah.
My wife, who, you know, she tolerates wrestling because of me, but she listens to rap music and she's into it. She'll be like, I remember when that first happened, she'd be like, did you know that Ric Flair is in a rap video? I'm like, no, I have no idea. She showed it to me. I was like, oh, Rick, what are you doing? But there's that. I mean, it goes back even to, I think Ludacris, right? Had the song where he talked about Dusty Rhodes.
Yes. Yep.
Right.
Yep.
I mean,
what would you say was the biggest celebrity that you were surprised, shocked that was a wrestling fan? And I'm talking about a big wrestling fan.
That you ran into. Oh boy.
That's a good question.
That puts me on the spot. People that were big fans that I would not have believed were big fans. Well, there were minor celebrities like that I would run into that I would realize were big fans that I would see backstage. Because a lot of those times, when those big celebrities would come backstage, it wasn't even that they were big fans. They just wanted to be around something, you know. I mean, Method Man is probably up there. I had no idea that he was a huge wrestling fan, and he knew everything, and he knew everybody. Sometimes when we would get celebrities involved, it was because they were fans. So, like, that was the connection of how we could get them interested. Like, in the early days, that was a lot harder to do because, like, in the 80s, let's say, you know, when wrestling had just gone mainstream, a lot of those people wanted nothing to do with it, and they had to, like, beg them and pay them a lot of money. And I'm not saying they still don't pay people to do it, but when you see people like Logan Paul, who's, like, one of the most famous people in the world, or Bad Bunny, another one of the most famous people in the world, and they want to be a part of it, like, that never used to happen. Like, they want to really seriously be a part of it because they're huge fans. But as far as people that I would discover, I don't know. I can't really think of any other big ones off the top of my head. I may think of some as a little bit later, but
if you go back
to Wale too. He has.
Oh, right. Well, he does his own thing, Wale Mania. Well,
Wale
right?
Mania. Every year for WrestleMania.
That's crazy that he's again. That was another thing. My wife will just be like, "What? Like, why? Why is he doing that?" Because she knows him from his music, and she'll be like, "This guy's bigger than wrestling. He shouldn't be doing stuff like that." And I'm like, "I don't know if he's bigger than wrestling."
So funny story about that. I actually went to Wale Mania in Dallas, WrestleMania Dallas, and that place was packed. It was at the House of Blues in Dallas, and when I tell you. He made that crowd, because most of that crowd were there because they thought it was a Wale rap show. They didn't realize he was going to do a podcast, that you were going to have Omos doing karaoke. But by the end of the night, you had all these people that were genuine rap fans trying to find out about these wrestlers. Because this event, like I said, Street Profits did karaoke. It was just a really fun environment. Yeah. So by the end, I think we got to salute Wale for that, because he actually transitioned people that didn't even watch wrestling into the end of that night.
That's crazy, because that could have gone a totally different way.
Oh,
that
my gosh.
A
Listen,
very, very bad way.
The party was 75% women probably at first, right?
Right.
So, you know, a lot of those ladies are like, oh, my God, what is this? But by the end of the night, especially, it doesn't hurt that all the wrestlers are all muscled up and looking right. All good. The ladies.
Well, you got to think, though. You go back in time. You got to think about how much, you know, wrestling had a niche audience. Hip hop had a niche audience, especially if you looked at it from the cultural standpoint of it, when it was just the elements, breaking, graffiti, DJing, MCing. It was niche. But when they started to filter into mainstream pop culture, they both started coming up at the same time. So you go back in that early, you know, that mid-80s era hip hop, it was a lot of those dudes making wrestling references.
Yes.
And a lot of the wrestlers, especially the ones who operated in the New York area, were fans of Curtis Blow and Grandmaster Flash and Furious Five and the Juice Crew. The list goes on and on. But they was, you know, they started to come up around the same time. And then, you know, that crossover started to happen. And still people aren't as aware of it as they could be. But it's, you know, you got cast like Wale who helped and others. But yeah, man, you know, wrestling references have been in hip hop.
I grew up in Brooklyn in the 70s and 80s. So, you know, I remember from the very beginning of a lot of that stuff.
BK to the fullest.
Exactly.
That's what's up.
Yeah. The BK borough. Although I like to tell people, like, my Brooklyn, where I grew up, it was less of like the Biggie Smalls Brooklyn and more of like Saturday Night Fever Brooklyn. Okay,
all right.
I was in the South part, but we still had a lot of awareness, especially like because I was on the forefront. I grew up in this heavy Italian neighborhood in Brooklyn, and so we were on the forefront of when white kids started to discover hip hop. We were like right on the physical geographical boundary, so like it hit us before I think it hit anyone else in America. And like that was one of the first things, any other white kids in America anyway, and that was one of the first things that I noticed about it. I mean, even in the, because I was a wrestling fan in the 80s, and I would hear, I'm trying to think of someone like the earliest ones, I would hear people and I'd be like, did he just say Jimmy Superfly Snuka? Like did that guy just mention, you know, that his name? I'm trying to think of who it was. That there were a few rap groups that where they would just drop these names, and this is even back in the 80s.
Yeah.
And I just think like I think there was a lot of crossover in the fandom. That was and I don't think that's even changed, that it's a big part of the fan base of wrestling and WWE at its height. Has been with minority audiences. I think that WWE has a lot to be grateful for, a lot of support from those particular parts of the market. So I think it's no secret, it's no like mystery why that happened. There's just a lot of overlap.
Oh, they definitely tapped in. Let's go back. The WWF Aggression album. when they flipped all the wrestling theme songs into rap songs. If you remember that, we had Kurt Angle doing a rap song. It was hilarious, but I mean, they definitely tapped into that. Even you going back to what you just said, Def Jam. the biggest rap label in the world, did a video game called Def Jam Vendetta, Def Jam Fight for New York.
Oh, right.
And they were the rappers in a wrestling ring doing wrestling moves. So, mm-hmm. I mean, actually, amazing video game, by the way.
I think Das FX was the group I was trying to think of because they used to do all these crazy cultural references, and a lot, and some of them would be wrestling or like old TV commercials from the 70s and all these things that we remembered because we were the right age. And yeah, I mean, like just growing up at that time, it was such a crazy time because we would see both of these things exploding at the same time. It really was the 80s. They were both exploding at the same time. Wrestling was becoming super mainstream and rap music was becoming super mainstream all at once.
Let me give you a good, let me give you a really good example.
Go ahead.
It was the Method Man connection.
Being in an arena, being in an arena full of fans, full of hip hop fans, when Outkast performs Southern Playlist of Cadillac Music and Andre comes in with his verse, which starts, "Time to drop these bowls like dusty roads," and you hear everybody in the crowd all in unison say that part.
The dusty roads thing is great because I feel like, I mean, we're living in this time now. It's so crazy and it's all because of Cody, but Dusty Roads, I feel like, is more well-known now than he has been in about 40 years. It's crazy to me. Like every young fan has this appreciation for what he did and who he was and how he was a big deal. And I just think that's great because he's somebody who I think his reputation, it's nice to see that it's lifted up because I'm old enough to remember when the smart wrestling fans did not like Dusty Rhodes, when they thought
I can tell you, being a kid who came up in the inner city, the streets had love for Dusty Rhodes.
Oh, he'd be the first one to tell you back then. He never got tired of talking about that. I interviewed him when I worked at WWE, and I did I recently shared it, one of my archive interviews where I asked him where the bionic elbow came from, like where that idea came from. And that's when he told me one of those stories. He was like, I'll do my awful Dusty Rhodes impression fine. He was like, "Let me tell you, I was hanging out one time with my street." He goes, "My street brothers. You know what I mean? My street brothers." And I'm like, "I know what you mean, Dusty." And he goes, "And one of them told me, 'Dream, that elbow you got, that's bionic.'" And I said, because, you know, the $6 million man was on TV and the whole the bionic woman. And so that's, I guess, where he got the idea for the bionic elbow from his quote-unquote street brothers. But, yeah, I mean,
so cool.
But he appealed across all demographics.
Oh, my God, yes.
Like, the average fan, I'm not talking about people that read The Observer, right? But the average fan, they loved him, white, black, everybody. I mean, they just, everybody loved Dusty Rhodes.
Right now, there's a clip from back in the day, I guess the NWA played a basketball game, a charity basketball game against the Charlotte Police. I reshared it myself. I mean, people are sharing that video from 40 years ago. It's doing 1 million views of seeing Dusty Rhodes making layups and passing it to Sting and him getting a shot. But like you said, it's just so many people now are connected to Dusty Rhodes. I got to meet Dusty at my tryout back in Florida Championship Wrestling. And it was so crazy because my catchphrase used to be, "What's my name?" It was really goofy, but I always said it. And sitting there when Dusty's talking to me, and he says, "You know what? I can't do a good Dusty, so I'm not going to try." But Dusty said, "See, all you guys out here, you can wrestle better than Whip. But you know what? I remember Whip because he's a big dude. And he said, 'What's my name? I don't know none of you guys. You're not doing nothing.'" But it was like, it was captivating by him saying that. And it just made me feel so good. And ever since then, I mean, I would tweet Dusty every so often. And, you know, that one response what made me feel amazing. Like, "Dusty, I was the guy that said, 'What's my name?' 'Oh, yeah, I remember you. But you got to get a better outfit. Your outfit looks horrible.'" Okay, Dusty.
Okay, Dusty. But he was great like that. He was he was just, you know, of the people. And I know that, you know, he had a reputation behind the scenes for sometimes not everybody always got along with him. And he could sometimes, you know, it's that same reputation that anybody who gets power in wrestling gets, where sometimes they play favorites and they bury people they don't like or whatever. And I know that there were times when he was like one of those examples of people where they would say, like, sometimes the heels would be nicer to the fans than the baby faces were, like away from the ring. Yeah. He was an example of that. But as a performer, he united everybody. He just, there was just something. And like what he said to you makes perfect sense because he got that. He was one of the first guys, especially as a face, to understand that you don't have to be the greatest wrestler in the world. Like, what did he do? You know, what did he actually do in the ring, right? I mean, like, he did an elbow, he did flip, flop, and fly, and all these things, but it didn't matter. He was more over than anybody in the whole business.
He did funky chicken, man.
Yeah.
Did the funky chicken, man.
he danced around.
Hogan credits him as being his favorite wrestler growing up, even though the timeline is a little weird. Sometimes Hogan kind of, you know what I mean? I love Hogan, but sometimes Hogan kind of shifts his stories. But yeah, he said Dusty was, that's what he says in his book, that Dusty was his favorite wrestler growing up. I'm like, bro, you were like 2 years younger than Dusty. Shut up. But
that's, yeah, that's a little dubious because I think especially like by the time Dusty was like a really big hit, I have no doubt. See, that's the thing. Hogan, he just puts all these weird, like you try to figure out what the truth is. The truth is in there somewhere.
Right.
Because we know that Hogan grew up in the Florida area. He was a fan of the Eddie Graham promotion. In fact, I think he was kind of a regular in the crowd, and he would sort of stand out because he was such a huge guy that they would be like, well, who's that really gigantic fan, like with the blonde hair and everything? He should be one, you know, he should be in the locker room. So I mean, like, it's believable that he definitely was a fan of Dusty Rhodes. But by the time Dusty became a hit, first of all, Hogan would have been like already about like 21 years old, and Hogan got into the business probably like about 3 or 4 years after Dusty really exploded as a star. So I mean, there's some truth in there. He probably admired him, he probably was a fan, but he wasn't a kid.
This ain't growing, right? Exactly.
You know, that's Hogan. That's just, oh man, the Hogan stories I have, I don't even know where to begin. Just I stayed at his house.
Oh, seriously?
Yeah, for a couple of days. We were doing a magazine about him when he had the big comeback in 2001. And then when he went back to Red and Yellow in 2002, we did this whole thing. We went down to Clearwater, stayed there a couple of days. Man, surreal. Bubba the Love Sponge was hanging around. It was exactly what you would expect.
Oh, so Bubba really was around all that time also.
Let me tell you, so he had an entourage. It really was like, this was at the height of The Sopranos.
Okay.
And you could tell that it had rubbed off on them, first of all, because everybody called him T, because his first name is Terry, right? Yeah. So they all called him T, which is also what all the guys call Tony on The Sopranos. Like, they always call him T. So he had his crew, and it was like Bubba the Love Sponge was in there. Brutus Beefcake was there everywhere he went. Brian Knobbs was a part of that, and it was like this whole clique, and it was exactly what you think. Like, this was right before Hogan Knows Best had even come on TV. Okay. So, but that house, that big house right on the water, that's where we were. And we went to, him and Linda were still together. We went to Linda's restaurant and I met his kids, and it was wild. His daughter, Brooke, who was, I want to say, he was trying to make her already into a superstar at that point. He's like, brother, we're going to make her into the next Britney Spears. I remember him telling me that. And she was maybe like 14 years old.
Oh, wow.
And
okay. She
was taller than me. Like, she was, if you told me she was 25, I would have agreed with you. Like, she was the maitre, the greeter at the restaurant. They had her, like, when you walk in the door, she was the first person you saw. And Nasty Nick was there, Hogan's son, who is now behind bars. He was like 12 years old.
Yeah.
But that was a crazy experience, just hanging around with him for a couple of days.
I will say, a lot of people can say what they want about Hogan now, though. But I will say, his fandom, I don't think it has faned as much as people think it has. I was at the Arnold Sports Classic in Columbus, Ohio. And, you know, that is a huge event, if you're familiar with it.
Yes.
Arnold Schwarzenegger walked past us. But understand, Hogan had a line for autographs. It probably had 8,000 people in that line. And probably even more. And people, you were allowed to skip the line for like $175 to get an autograph and picture with them. And when I tell you, Hogan probably came out of there that day making about $500,000, I would not be surprised, because those people were going crazy. They were following Arnold until they saw Hogan. It turned like right around.
I think the thing that people underestimate with Hogan is because he was so good at making, like Dusty Rhodes, because he was so good at making a connection with people, especially from when you're a small child, for most of his fan base were like little boys, you know. Once that connection is made, that is very, very hard for people to ever even think about wanting to let go of. You know what I mean? Like, that's for life. You want to talk about NWO for life? That's for life. So for a lot of people, there's a lot of people, especially of an age, let's say, that were around, that just, they are going to be fans no matter what. And I find that it's easier for a younger fan who has no connection to someone like that, and it really doesn't mean all that much to them. It's like way before their time. And so it's easy for them to look with clear eyes and say like, ah, you know, why should I be a fan of this guy, you know, after things that he said or done, because they never had that bond and that connection. And it's this weird thing that some people will never let go of.
Did you ever, when he first had his situation, when the racist tape or whatever came out, because I was one of the biggest Hogan's fans. I saw him at WrestleMania 3 in Detroit, was a fan ever since. So that was 7 years old, and I'm 43 now. That happened about when I was 35, 36 or whatever. And all I can say is when it happened, you know the Michael Jordan crying meme?
Yes.
I posted that, but he had like a Hulk Hogan bandana on. So it was like, man, Hogan, why'd you do it? But because I had that connection with him, I was like, well, it was just too many years to totally give up. You know what I mean? And I understand people do make mistakes or whatever, but I was still a Hogan fan to this day. I mean, I went to his shop in Tampa and still was hoping he would show up. So I can't even say I'm not still a Hogan fan.
Well, we've talked about him before, and I brought up the thing of how, you know, you can't, no matter what, you can't get around the fact of how important he was to the business. It's irrefutable, and for anybody that wants to learn about it and study it or write about it or appreciate it, there's just, you know, it's just an undeniable fact. So it's like, what I would love to see from him and what I wish I could see, just because he is such an important person who really should be recognized, is I'd like to see more that gives me the feeling that he is sorry and wants to move forward and genuinely, because like I never got that sense from him. It always just feels more like, and maybe it's just me projecting, but it always just feels more like he's just trying to get past it and move on and have people forget. Like I think people would have a much easier time if he really, truly, genuinely seemed to kind of own up to it. And I think, honestly, that. I think people would welcome him back with open arms because they want to. People want to like Hulk Hogan. And it's hard when it just doesn't come across. Like nowadays, like look what they did with him at the Royal Rumble, where they did that package. Now, that was great. I thought that was an awesome video they put together. But it's very telling. They did it as a pre-tape.
Yep.
They know they can't put him in front of a live crowd. He'll get eaten alive. That's a big problem. Did you even notice when Triple H mentioned at the press conference at Royal Rumble, he was mentioning individual superstars, right, from the past. He mentioned, he didn't say Hulk Hogan. He said Randy Savage and Hulk Hogan. Now, that's very calculated because he knows he links those two names together. You're going to cheer because the first name you hear is Randy Savage. They're very, it's like they're dancing around this thing. They have this guy, they're kind of stuck with him because he's like this huge part of their legacy. They don't want to just pretend he doesn't exist, but they know that there's a huge portion of the fan base that does not want to see this guy. It's a problem.
You know what? Hulk Hogan exists in a space that a lot of celebrities don't achieve. And you talk about him, you know, being a part of people's childhood. Like Hulk Hogan is in the same place that people have Garfield, Bugs Bunny, G.I. Joe, and Transformers. That's where he is. That's where he exists. And I agree with you. He has seemed to just want to try to move past it. And very calculating the way he kind of kind of dodges. But I think he needs to absorb those punches and really feel them and reciprocate with some sincerity. And I think he probably would be welcome back because the people who have, like Whip, who saw that it was just, you know, devastated and so disappointed by it, is because not just the adult, but that younger person inside who saw him as, you know, the way a crowd looks at Superman on a cartoon, you know, like, wow, there he is. That's who he was. And if he can just be sincere and express, you know, some anything, man, just let people know that you're mournful for your behavior. You know what I mean? And that
exactly
acknowledge the fact that you hurt a lot of people.
But you guys are right, man, about Hogan. He definitely needs to show a little bit more remorse. And he needs a better PR team, man. Because right after it happened, I understand the logic. But then on his social media, he posted pictures of every black guy he ever knew in life. Taking Mike Tyson's hand and everybody else. Like, come on, man. Now you're pandering, bro. But
they do that. Ric Flair did the same thing when he was getting all that heat from the plane ride from hell. Like, he was trying to turn himself into Mother Teresa and all these things. And these guys, they just panic. I think that's a lot of what happens too, is they just go into panic mode. But yeah, wrestlers need in general better PR teams, because the way that was handled was really, really bad. Even if, you know, like I was saying, I think there are a lot of people, and this doesn't just go for Hogan in this case, it goes for a lot of celebrities that do crummy things of all different kinds. They still have a lot of fans who would be willing to accept them back and forgive them and things in a heartbeat if they really genuinely feel like it's earned. And sometimes it doesn't always feel earned. That's the thing I was trying to say about it.
For sure, man.
But I write the stuff I write about, I'm writing about Hogan all the time, and not just him, but other people in wrestling who have done horrible things. And, you know, God, I'm doing this gorilla book. Vince is going to be all over the damn book. So it's like, you can't just relitigate it every time you talk about the person. You have to be able to write about what your focus, the subject matter you're focusing on, without ignoring things. But it can't just always be there hanging over everything that you write about. That's a problem you struggle with some of these people in wrestling. There's a lot of people in wrestling who have skeletons in their closet. There's no question about it. It's a struggle, no doubt about it.
They got graveyards in their closet,
man.
I know, it's really, I don't even know where all the stuff that's been happening, knowing what we know, what older fans know, and people have been covering it for a long time. You're just waiting for so many shoes to drop. It's not even the other shoe. It's like a whole closet full of shoes. Mm-hmm. You're waiting and waiting, and it's ugly. It's ugly for sure.
Just have a shoe carnival cave in on you. That's what it's called.
Yeah, exactly. Well, guys, this conversation went all over the place, which I'm totally glad that it did, because that's really always my goal, and you guys didn't disappoint me. So I'm glad that we decided to do this. We touched on so many interesting things. It's almost like this was a continuation of when I was on your show. So I kind of like that. And I thank you guys for taking the time out to do it.
For sure, man. We appreciate you having us, man. It was a ball.
I enjoyed every second of it.
Yes, sir.
There you have it, folks. My conversation with Deshaun Whipple and Joe Walker of the Whip Show podcast. And I want to thank those guys for taking time out of their busy schedule to come and be guests on Shut Up and Wrestle for this very special three-person panel. Now, for next week's show, I've also got something great planned for you guys related to the world of wrestling media. She is a fellow member of the Pro Wrestling Illustrated masthead. You may also have seen her on many a pro wrestling red carpet. Her name is Candice Cordelia. And she will be my guest next week on Shut Up and Wrestle, as well as many other guests in the weeks to come. The one and only king of recovery himself, Jim Valley, wrestling historian and podcaster, gonna be a guest on the show. I have got wrestling announcer extraordinaire Kevin Kelly, on the way to Shut Up and Wrestle in the weeks to come, as well as historian Matt Farmer. What else? My goodness, so much. Lou Kippelman of the Arcadian Vanguard family will be making his way finally, to Shut Up and Wrestle. I've got another roundtable. I know a lot of people enjoyed the WWE employee roundtable. I've got a second one in the works. with a few other good friends and former colleagues of mine. And I'm even doing something a little bit different here that I don't know if any wrestling podcaster has ever done. I am going to bring on my wife. That is right. The beleaguered and supportive Mrs. Brian Solomon. That's Jamie Smith Solomon to you. She will be coming on to Shut Up and Wrestle to talk about exactly what it is like living in a house with somebody who won't shut the hell up about old school wrestling. All of that and more is coming to Shut Up and Wrestle in the weeks to come. So many places you can find it and listen to it. There is the webpage for Shut Up and Wrestle, which is suawpod.com. That, in addition to Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Podbean, Podcast Addict, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find this show. I also encourage you to join the Facebook group, Shut Up and Wrestle with Brian R. Solomon. And if you're inclined to make a small, modest, yet greatly appreciated financial contribution to Shut Up and Wrestle, I encourage you to go to my Twitter page. That's Brian R. Solomon. There's a button at the top with a little dollar symbol on it. You can contribute via Venmo or Cash App. If you'd like to contribute via PayPal, you can find me at BrianRSolomon@yahoo.com. It is a free show, but any contributions are nevertheless appreciated. Some of the other projects that I work on each and every morning from Arcadian Vanguard, it's the Wrestling News. Find it at thewrestlingnews.com or go to the YouTube page for Arcadian Vanguard. The books that I have written, Blood and Fire, the unbelievable real-life story of wrestling's original Sheik, as well as Superheroes, the history of a pop culture phenomenon from Ant-Man to Zorro, can be found wherever books are sold, or reach out to me at BrianRSolomon@yahoo.com if you're interested in buying a signed copy. The magazines that I write for, I mentioned at the top of the show, Inside the Ropes, which you can get at InsideTheRopesMagazine.com. There's also a little magazine called Pro Wrestling Illustrated. May have heard of it. Get it at PWI-Online.com. If you're looking for me on social media, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Brian R. Solomon. You can also find my author page on Facebook, which is Brian Solomon Writer. And on any of those social media platforms, you will find the link to my author webpage on the World Wide Web. Shut Up and Wrestle is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. And as always, this has been Brian R. Solomon asking you to keep those cards and letters coming in and saying you may be right, I may be crazy, but it just may be a lunatic you're looking for. So long, wrestling fans. I need your